My name is Bill. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Bill.
Who's going to present me?
I'm presenting.
Since we're near Christmas, I guess this is more appropriate now than usual. If you're new, I'd like to welcome you to the land of misfit toys. As far as I'm concerned, that's who we are. But we're very real about it. We're damaged, but we're real about it. Which is a lot more than a lot of places in the world are willing to do. So I find AA rather interesting because a lot of the other, or I should say a lot of the religions and spiritual paths, they take a long time to get to the point of powerlessness. They develop a whole entire process for somebody to realize that, wow, I'm really worse off and I'm really lost and I'm really powerless. But the cool thing about AA is we start with that. So I find that rather interesting, rather advanced, and rather advantageous compared to other paths that perhaps lead to awakening or whatever you want to call it. So I see the 12 steps as having an advantage over some other systems that have the same goal and the same thing in mind. So I'm going to cover 2 and 3 tonight, steps 2 and 3. Let me just quickly do sort of a review of 1. I find the steps rather interesting. As far as I'm concerned, there's one step with 12 parts. It's sort of like a wave where, let's say somebody that you know lives in the center of the United States and they've never seen the ocean. And you say, you know, I'm gonna send you a picture of the ocean. So you go to the Jersey Shore and you take a picture of the ocean and you put it in an envelope and you mail it to your friend. Now, the problem with that is what you're sending them is not a wave, because the nature of a wave is movement. The nature of the wave is there a whole bunch of stuff. There's stuff that happens before you even see anything. And then, you know, sort of the wave begins, and then it rises, and then it continues rising, and then it sort of peaks, and then it sort of comes over, and then it sort of goes down, and then it goes in, and then it sort of evens off. And then there's movement under the water, but you don't necessarily see that. Now it's just even. So it starts even, and stuff's happening before there's any movement on the top. And then there's stuff that happens above the water, and then it goes back down into the water again. And that's a wave. But you can't take a picture of a wave. So it's always really strange to, like, you know, let's talk about step 5. Well, you know, there's a whole bunch of waveness happening leading up to it. So it's always hard to sort of just talk about a piece of it without talking about what leads up to it and what continues after it, because it's more than just a piece. You can't just take a picture of it. It's a whole bunch of stuff going on before, during, and after the picture, so to speak. One of the ways that I like describing the steps is let's say we're new. Step 1 is where you are. Step 2 is where you want to get to. And steps 3 through 12 is how you get there. So it's sort of like a map. You have to find out where you are, and you have to find out where you want to go to before you can then choose a route. So there's another really excellent way of describing the steps that I especially love. I didn't come up with this, but I really, really like the emphasis, especially toward the end. What this gentleman says is that steps 1, 2, and 3 are AA considered. Steps 4 through 9 is AA learned. And then steps 10, 11, and 12, your AA life begins. And I really love that because it emphasizes that there's really nothing going on for you until you get to the end of the step process. And then, and as far as I'm concerned, only then do you have something to contribute at discussion meetings or whatever you want to call it, because now you're involved in what the essence of what the transformation is that AA has to offer, and then now you have something to contribute at a meeting. Prior to that, you're basically just sharing the problem and you're sharing the perspective of the problem. And sometimes you sound a little better than other times, but you're still sharing from the perspective of the problem. And I really love that version of, you know, the essence of the steps, because, you know, I would say he's correct in emphasizing that, you know, really until you get to the end of the process and everything has changed for you on the inside, and you start to see that nothing needed to change on the outside, that your perspective and your self-centeredness and all of that and your separation from the power is what the problem is. And then through the process of the steps, then it completely changes your perspective. It completely changes and alters, or rather takes away, our self-centeredness. And then now we can finally and only live what could be called a successful life. Because now I'm not self-sabotaging everywhere I go. There's this really great phrase that I heard somebody say one time, and they said that, you know, if you haven't worked the steps, you're still in an abusive relationship with yourself. I love that line. And it's so true, because, you know, it's like, that was absolutely true. What was going on up here before I found a solution was really dark and really ugly and really scary. And to be honest with you, that was on a good day. You know what I mean? Like, you know, let alone all the other, you know, things that you want to pile on top of that. So I said last week that our problem is physical, mental, and spiritual, and our solution is physical, mental, and spiritual. Mm-hmm. Physically, the problem is that we have when an alcoholic drinks alcohol, we set up a craving where we can't safely predict how far it's going to go once we start drinking. That a non-alcoholic, after a few drinks, just stops. They have a natural... you see, alcohol is a poison. So regular people have a natural and a normal response to alcohol, that they get this out of control beginning of a nauseating, I don't like this, I don't want any more kind of a feeling. And then they say things like, you know, I don't want any more to drink because I'm feeling the first one. Well, I'm feeling the first one and I love what it's doing for me, and that's why I'm going to get more. And, you know, they look at me strange and I look at them strange because they're having a completely different experience than I'm having. Alcohol does something for me. Alcohol makes me comfortable in my own skin. Alcohol creates within me what I would call today, but I didn't have the language to use this when I was drinking. Alcohol causes for me a spiritual experience. That I drink alcohol and then I get this in control, get up and go into town, I really like this, oh, I'm more a yeah kind of a feeling. And that's and so, you know, when people would say to me, you know, maybe you shouldn't drink, or maybe you should drink less. You know, I was just like, you know, what are you talking about? Like, you know, it's obviously not doing for you what it's doing for me, but because you would never ask me to stop. But alcohol was the great elixir in my life, as far as I'm concerned. It totally did something for me that I couldn't do for myself and that I never found anywhere else, except certain drugs. So physically, a part of it is that we set up a craving. We have an abnormal reaction to alcohol. It has to do with metabolism, and alcohol does something for us that it doesn't do for the normal person. It only does something like what I'm talking about for 13% of the world. 13% of the world are alcoholics, so the other 87% of the world, which is a normal reaction, is this, you know, out of control, I don't like this kind of a thing. And then also another aspect of the physical, as far as I'm concerned, is that alcohol creates this ease and comfort. I walked into a bar spitting bullets, angry at everybody, and after a few drinks, I was problem-free and wondering why you wouldn't want to talk to me, because I'm so special. And prior to having a few drinks, I couldn't understand why anybody would want to talk to me, because I was such a loser. And then, you know, mentally, there's a mental obsession. And that is that our mind doesn't tell us the truth about alcohol and the problems that it causes. It only brings to mind the ease and comfort that's going to come once I start drinking. It doesn't highlight you know, the arrests, the breakup of the relationships, and the loss of jobs, some of which were very recent. It just comes to mind that, you know, this time it's going to be different. You're not going to get arrested this time. You're not going to get into a fight. You're not going to whatever. And, you know, you're only going to have one or a couple, you know. And then the spiritual malady is always kind of interesting to talk about. And I have this really great quote I'm going to share with you. It's probably the greatest description of the spiritual malady I've ever heard. And it was just something that somebody said spontaneously at a conference. And I was just like, I got the recording and I was like, I'm going to write that down. It's like the greatest description of the spiritual malady I've ever heard of. But the spiritual malady generally is the 12 and 12 talks about it in regard to self-centered fear. And the spiritual malady, I talked about it last week. In the doctor's opinion, it refers to it as restless, irritable, and discontent. I shared last week that I really love that word, irritable, because that means easily annoyed. And that, you know, described most of my life prior to the awakening. And there's other parts of the book that describe the spiritual malady. One of the ways that I describe it is that, you know, you're not acting the way I want you to. Life isn't happening the way I want it to. You know, lots of fear, lots of resentment, lots of anger, lots of shame, lots of feeling different, lots of something's not right, lots of uncomfortability. And there's just this hole in my gut that I can't fill with anything that works until I drink. And then when I drink, it reduces all those crazy voices and all those crazy emotions down to when I drink it. Before I drink, there's this committee of voices and emotions that are just overwhelming and that are kind of ugly and that are sort of chewing me up and spitting me out. And then I take, I have the, you know, that's sort of a committee, let's call it, the itty-bitty shitty committee, let's call it. And then I have a few drinks, and then those voices get reduced to one voice. Mm. And that one voice is,
more.
Have another drink. The craziness of attack inside my mind and inside my gut sort of shifts. Maybe to the back the, not the forefront, but the rear back. Is that an expression?
Mm-hmm.
You know, I can't seem to be all right within myself, and then I take a few drinks, and suddenly I am all right within myself. And then what's strange is that then I want to drink more because, you know, if two drinks is good, then 10 is super good. You know what I mean? If three are really good, you know, 6 is phenomenal. And these drinking problems begin to develop. And in my case, I started drinking alcoholically when I was 17. It was kind of like I had my first drink at 13. I started drinking sort of a couple times a month when I was 16. I was drinking weekly when I was 17. I was drinking basically daily from 18 to 30. And from 18 to 30, then there started to be these drinking problems directly related to my drinking. And anybody that drinks the way that I did will have drinking problems, whether they're an alcoholic or not. And then I stopped drinking, so I thought, doesn't that mean that the problem's supposed to go away? And I had 3.5 years, and I was still miserable, and I was still angry, and I was still afraid, and I was still weird and pissed off, and I was still uncomfortable, and I was still feeling not a part of. And I had 3.5 years, and that's pretty successful in AA. And what happened to me and what happens to a lot of us is that, you know, you begin to develop sort of this image. You can't admit that you're not doing well because, you know, people are sort of looking up to you. Some people are asking you to work with them. Mm-hmm. I have nothing to offer anybody. I'm a total fake. And then I started thinking myself out of AA again because if this is what it's going to be like, I might as well just drink because this sucks. So, and you know, that can last whether we're drinking or not. You know what I mean? If I'm not seeking a spiritual solution, that's going to last and just get better if I'm not, you know, whether I'm drinking or not. If I'm lucky, I'm going to drink again. Yes, I am saying if you're lucky, you're going to drink again. Because you see, if you drink again, if you're suffering from that, and you drink again, at least you have moments of relief, you have moments of escape. But if you don't, if you're not lucky enough to drink again, now you're just going to get a progressively more miserable as time passes, and you have no way to get rid of it. You have no way to get out of it. It's always there. And I wouldn't wish it on my worst enemy. And this is how Wayne B. describes a spiritual malady. This is absolutely mind-blowing how accurate he is. And like I said, he just spontaneously said this during his talk. He starts off by saying, I am maladjusted to life, in full flight from reality, and an outright mental defective. Thanks for pointing that out, Dr. Silkworth. That means whether I'm drinking or not, although I look like a full-grown adult, I remain childish, grandiose, and gravely emotionally immature. As a going human concern, my natural state is one of growing anxiety, depression, or fear, coupled with an intense desire for excitement, a condition of being which is exacerbated with and complicated by an obsessive, compulsive, impulsive, excessive, controlling demanding need for attention, acceptance, and unqualified approval, a condition of being which renders me restless, irritable, and discontented with my life. Mentally, my thought life is controlled by 100 forms of fear, self-delusion, self-seeking, and self-pity, all of which drive me to live my life according to selfish, dishonest, self-seeking, inconsiderate, resentful, and frightened motives, motives which left unattended in me arouse and engage dangerous and life-threatening level of lust. I try not to make eye contact. Pride, anger, envy, greed, sloth, gluttony. I turn into a pig. I want it all. That renders me a bit emotionally sensitive, which means I have a strong tendency toward taking everybody I see and hear personally. I have a strong tendency toward taking everything I see and hear personally. I don't like criticism, and I'll be damned if I can stand praise because I don't believe you. When it comes to suffering emotionally, I don't like to suffer emotionally. I don't suffer well, and I don't suffer alone. You know how we, you know, we torture everybody around us?
Right.
Socially, I'm a bankrupt idealist and a brooding perfectionist who lives defensively and guarded in fear of being found out. As such, I tend to rationalize, minimize, justify, and deny all of my actions while casting blame upon innocent people in a vigorous attempt to avoid attention. When it comes to my fellow man and woman, I demand the absolute possession and control of everybody and every circumstance that enters my arena of life. My response to you is that I'm quick to anger, I'm slow to virtue, and I get a distinct and succinct delight and a twisted pleasure out of judging and criticizing everybody I see. My outstanding characteristic is defiance, and rebellion dogs my every step. Now, as a child of God, that is a list of some of my finer qualities. And then he goes, does anybody want a date? And then he said, and this is important, he says, you'll hear this at every meeting you go to, but from newcomers, this is how you'll hear it. I don't fit in. I don't belong. I'm not a part of. My God, what is wrong with me? I must be different. And then he says, and the only thing that satisfies that restless, irritable, and discontented nature in me is alcohol and drugs. But you see, in a vision for you, it tells me that there is a sufficient substitute, and it's vastly more than that, so I don't have to drink, and I don't need to run away anymore. Is that just the most mind-blowing thing you've ever heard?
Mm.
I remember when I first heard that, it was like so shocking to me, because first of all, you know, how did he know that about me? And I've never heard it put in such a full way. I've heard bits and pieces of all of that, but I had never heard it put in such a full, like, you know, succinct way. I had never heard it put, like, so pathetically and so crazily as to come close to what my inner experience was for so, so long. Now, you don't have to turn here necessarily. The first paragraph of chapter 4, which is We Agnostics. Step 1 is found in the doctor's opinion, Bill's story, There is a Solution, and more about alcoholism. Almost all of step 1 is in there. And then step 2 is found a little bit in there is a Solution, and basically is outlined in We Agnostics, which is chapter 4. But the first paragraph of We Agnostics, which is the big shift from step 1 into step 2, has a review that's really, really good. It says, in the preceding chapters, you have learned something of alcoholism. We hope we have made clear the distinction between the alcoholic and the non-alcoholic. One, if when you honestly want to, you find you cannot quit entirely, and that's because of the mental obsession, and that's because of the spiritual malady. Or if when drinking, you have little control of the amount you take, which is because of the physical allergy. It says you are probably alcoholic. If that be the case, you may be suffering from an illness, which only a spiritual experience will conquer. Well, that's a statement that could be turned into a question. Do you believe that you suffer from illness, which only a spiritual experience will conquer? Mm-hmm. You see, we only have one problem, we only have one solution. We only have one problem, and that's separation from the power. We only have one solution, and that's conscious contact with the power. That's it. So in other words, you don't have a relationship problem, you have a spiritual problem. You don't have an issue with your boss at work, you have a spiritual problem. You don't have a spending problem, you have a spiritual problem. You don't have an alcohol problem, you have a spiritual problem. You don't have a drug problem, you have a spiritual problem. We only have one problem, and we only have one solution. In the 10-step promises, it talks about that the problem has been removed. Problem singular, we only have one problem. Separation from the power. And we only have one solution, and that's conscious contact with the power. By step 10, we're consciously connected, so the problem has been removed. It doesn't say the problem's been solved. It says that the problem's been removed. Because now we're connected. The problem was disconnection. Did I expect to discover this answer in AA? No, I did not. I expected to come to AA and to be taught how to drink and not get into trouble. That was what I expected. Unconsciously, that's what I expected when I came to AA. Needless to say, AA would be a much bigger fellowship if it wasn't for this don't drink thing. You know what I mean?
All right.
Now, this is really, really important. So drinking is not our problem. Drinking was the solution to the problem. Drinking was the solution and the only thing that helped us with the spiritual malady. Spiritual malady and the separation is our only problem, and alcohol helps us with that. It helped us with that in the past. It'll help us with that in the present. If we were to drink right now, it's going to work just as well as it did, you know, 26 years ago when I finally stopped for the last time. Just like it's going to work very, very well if I choose to drink in the future. It's going to work really, really well. It's going to take me from a crazy inner condition to a comfortable, sort of reasonable inner condition. But then what comes along with the drinking is drinking problems. So I have to replace the ease and comfort that comes at once by taking a few drinks with the ease and comfort that comes gradually over a period of time of working the steps and growing spiritually. I have to replace the ease and comfort that comes at once by taking a drink with the ease and comfort that happens gradually over time by working the steps and growing spiritually. I think I said it last week. There's a big difference between not drinking and not drinking and being happy about it. If I'm not drinking and I'm miserable, that's not a reasonable option. I'm not here to be miserable. If I'm going to be sober and miserable, I might as well just drink. Because at least I have moments of escape. It's interesting in the book. It says it on 25 and it says it on 44. On 25 at the very bottom it says, the bottom of 25, it says, we were in a position where life was becoming impossible and we had to pass into the region from which there is no return through human aid. We had but two alternatives. So there's no door number three. It says two alternatives. One was to go on to the bitter end, blotting out the consciousness of our intolerable situation as best we could, otherwise known as barely into step one, powerless and unmanageability. And it says, and the other was to accept spiritual help. And then on page 44 in the middle, it says, to be doomed to an alcoholic death or to live by spiritual basis are not easy alternatives to face. So there's no door number three. It says that if you're an alcoholic, the way that you're going to go is either a lot of booze or a lot of God. That's it. There's no door number three. Now, to put it another way, that I think, you know, I started talking about this, and for some reason it reached more people when I described it this way, as opposed to just leaving it at that. And what I mean is that, really, spiritually, the two options are misery or the unknown with a capital U. And the interesting thing about the alcoholic mind is that both options are unreasonable, because misery isn't necessarily so bad. It can sometimes be quite tolerable, because you see, at least I sometimes get my way. And, you know, at least it's my misery. You understand what I'm saying there? You know what I mean? It's like, you know, I'm just comfortable and familiar with it. You know what I mean? Like, but then the unknown with a capital U, that means I'm rarely going to get my way. And I'm not in control. And the alcoholic mind doesn't like that as an option. But then I'm just left with misery, and that's not a reasonable option. You understand? So there's sort of a deeper way of looking at it, that, you know, it's either the separation is just misery, and in my experience, all things like misery, spirituality, recovery, relationships, etc., it's either growing or it's dying. There's no staying still. Anything that's alive, like a plant, it's either growing or it's dying. It's never staying still. If you think, and I'm sorry to have to tell you this, if you think your relationship is currently just kind of staying still, that means it's dying. And you're just not in touch with it anymore, okay? It's like a dimmer switch, you know what I mean? It's either, the light is either growing in light, or it's going in darkness. And, you know, the whole, you know, misery isn't a reasonable option, and the unknown isn't a reasonable option. But we come to AA, and we see other people not only struggling with those two as an option, but also suggesting that when they really committed themselves to the unknown, that their life really got a whole lot better, and it was the greatest decision and the greatest shift that they've ever experienced. That's one of the key things about our fellowship, is that we should be a bunch of cheerleaders for the solution. When was the last time you were at a, you know, a regular meeting that seemed to you like it was a bunch of cheerleaders for the solution? This meeting is one of them. I'm familiar with what goes on at this meeting. I'm proud of you guys for being here and making this a priority and all of that, but your average discussion meeting is dedicated to the single most popular topic in AA when you're not living in the solution, and that is, who has an issue today? That's the single most popular topic of a non-solution-based meeting. Who has an issue today? Oh, you know, I had a, you know, this happened at work, you know, this happened at home. This happened with my kids. This happened with my family, with my job, at my home group's business meeting. Home group business meeting, that's a really juicy topic. I love the home group business meeting idea. It's interesting. I'm serious. The next home group business meeting you guys have, notice your mind at work with judging and criticizing, and, you know, you don't say it because, you know, it's not appropriate, but, you know, just look at watch your mind during your home group's business meeting at the next home group one. It's always really, really interesting because, you know, we know exactly what certain people are going to say. We know exactly who's not going to agree with us. You know what I mean? It's always really, really interesting. I was given this really great compliment soon after I started my home group, because my home group is the Tuesday night 7:15 Ridgewood meeting. It's a Pathway to Power. It's a big book meeting. And they do something that bothers me. You know what I mean? Because I'm really opinionated. Not that it shows here. But in their opening, they have this phrase, let's have a moment of silence to invite God in the room. And so I went to the home group and I said, why are we inviting God into a room where God already is? Why don't we say something like, you know, instead of why don't we invite God into the room, why don't we say something like, why don't we all, you know, spend some time acknowledging the God that's already here, or the higher power that's already here, or whatever. And oh man, that, you know, the group went at me, you know what I mean? We don't change things around here, you know what I mean? We don't visit and look at things that are, you know, that. And what I mean is that I was given this great compliment because after I realized that nobody in the group was really even willing to consider it, and they, on some level, didn't really understand what I was talking about, and then I just dropped it. And, you know, I never complained to anybody or anything. You know, I wanted to see, I'm sorry to put it this way, but I wanted to see how advanced the spirituality was with the members in the group, and I wasn't very happy with the result of it. there it is, right? There it is. I never brought it up again, and I never complained about it, and I just, okay, well, you know, I just dropped it. Like, I didn't even bring it to a vote. It was just really obvious that they weren't willing to consider what I was talking about, and then I just dropped it. And somebody after the meeting came over to me and said, you know, my sponsees were really impressed by the way you just accepted what everybody else had to say, even though it was different than what you were saying. And, you know what I mean? Like, unless it's against the traditions or something, you know, we have to accept the group conscience. We then don't strategically find another way to get our way at future business meetings. You understand? Which I'm sure nobody here has ever done, right? Or, you know, you didn't even hear of that, right? You know what I mean? We have to accept the group conscience. We have to assume that it's God speaking through the group conscience. Maybe that's a stretch, but yeah, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So you know, I was happy with how I handled that, and other people noticed, you know, whatever. But, you know, it's always kind of interesting. But also, this chapter that transitions in a great way from 1 to 2 is called We Agnostics. And I always like sharing this because for me it was really, really helpful. And I hope that it's helpful for you. The word agnostic comes from the word gnosis, which means knowledge. And when you put A-G in front of a word, that means without. So the word agnostic means without knowledge of God. But what I ended up doing was I did sort of a research of the root of the word gnosis, and it's not, I was really happy with what I found, because what I discovered was that it's not intellectual knowledge, it's experiential knowledge. So it's without experiential knowledge of God. That's what the word agnostic means. And it's interesting because in the 12 and 12 and in the big book, it only talks about atheist or agnostic way at the beginning of the step process and never mentions it again, because the assumption is, and if, you know, we're following along with how the steps work and we're experiencing what the steps are pointing to and trying to bring about, we begin to have experiential knowledge of God working in our lives. So, but, you know, the word agnostic still comes to play because one of the ways that I use it with my sponsor and sponsee lineage is we say to each other, you know, one of us will be talking about something and another one of us will say, well, that's your current agnosticism. Because there starts to be areas of our life where we have an experience of God and we have a concept of God or whatever you want to call that. But there's areas of our life where we're not including God. Like, you know, God can have my recovery, but my sex life, you know, I'm not going to ask him for help there. You know what I mean? That's our current agnosticism. You know what I mean? Like, you know, I'm stealing toilet paper from work, but, you know, I'm not going to ask God to help me with that. That's my current agnosticism. The areas of my life that I'm not including God, that I'm not including love, that I'm not including honesty, that I'm not including integrity, that I'm not including unselfishness. What that turns into is my current agnosticism, and it's going to be the area of my life that's going to get out of control, and then I'm going to need the inventory at some point in the future when I rework the steps. So so that whole thing about the word agnostic was really profound for me, because that was what I discovered. Some people, there's whole groups that refer to themselves as agnostic AA, and they remove every mention of God entirely, even from the steps. And that's not an agnostic point of view, that's an atheist point of view. Atheist groups have infiltrated our fellowship, and AA has not responded to it in a way that will deal with the problem, because as far as I'm concerned, what will deal with the problem is to encourage these people to start their own fellowship, not to try to acclimate to AA, because AA does believe in a higher power and does believe in a spiritual solution. And if they don't believe in that, then they should just start their own fellowship. They can even use the steps. Start your own fellowship. There's groups, there's these agnostic groups in AA that have an alternate version of the steps. They remove every reference to God. Mm-hmm. And if it's posted at their meeting, the New Jersey Intergroup has chosen to ask them to remove it. And I keep saying to them, don't just ask them to remove it. Ask them to start their own fellowship. I don't understand why we're trying to be everything for everyone. Mm. Once you show an alternate version of the steps, you have now affected AA as a whole. If you're new and you go to this meeting and you see those steps, and you go to a meeting every day of the week, and six times you see these steps, and then you go to one of those meetings and you say a completely alternate version of the steps, you know, is this AA? I mean, obviously an alternate, neutered, that's a good word, right? I don't get to use that very often. I love that word, right? Oh my God, I get points for using that in a sentence, right? A completely neutered version of the steps, like that's AA, like. And what the New York Intergroup did was they removed them from the meeting schedule.
Right.
But, once again, didn't say to them, start your own fellowship. As far as I'm concerned, you know, there's some hesitation to how to deal with this, and I think they should come to me. I have an answer, right? I just think that it hasn't been handled very well, and it is what it is. You know what I mean? So, let me talk a little bit about my experience with 2 and 3, because I'm a person that believes in working and reworking the steps. And always when I say that now, I didn't do this for a long time, but now I'm doing it all the time. When I talk about working and reworking the steps, when I'm talking about reworking the steps, I'm talking about reworking the steps a little bit differently each time. I'm not talking about reworking the steps exactly the way you did when you did it the first time. There's more than a couple different ways of using the big book to go through the steps. And there are some people, and I happen to be one of them just because I have a lot of experience, some people can take you further and deeper into the spirituality of the steps, and some people aren't necessarily well equipped because they haven't gotten there yet. So when I went through the steps the first time, 2 and 3 was rather worthless and weak, for lack of a better expression. Mm. And what I mean by that is that my sponsor, Howard, was Joe and Charlie. Charlie was his sponsor, as a matter of fact, so he was a Joe and Charlie guy. And 2 was basically, you know, we would read through the book and stuff like that, but there wasn't a lot of depth to 2 and 3. And 2 was, you know, do you now believe or are you even willing to believe that there's a power greater than you that can help you with your problem? And of course, my answer was yes. I was well into that already. It wasn't a risky question. It wasn't a stretch for me. And then 3 was also sort of very surface and not very deep spiritually. And what it was, you know, I now decide to go on to 4 through 9, or rather 4 through 12. And there wasn't a lot of depth there. And it was just to keep it moving and not much of anything else there. And then I did a really quality 4 and 5, and then There wasn't very much depth to 6 and 7. And then I did most of my 8 and 9, not all of it. And there wasn't much 10 and 11 stuff. And then I started sponsoring people. And then after about 5 years, I kind of just plateaued. And I knew that I had reached a point that I wouldn't be able to go beyond unless I do something. And I started searching out something that could help me go beyond how far I had gone this first time. And that was when I started hearing people talking about reworking the steps and having a deeper experience with it. And I'm grateful that that was how it happened for me. And then now, when I work with people, you know, I really drill down on 2 and 3, and I really drill down on 6 and 7, and I really drill down on 10 and 11, while also, you know, having a strong experience with the other ones as well. But I just saw, and I was sort of uniquely qualified to respond to the lack of 2 and 3, 6 and 7, and 10 and 11, because that was what I was doing, and that was what I was hearing a lot of other people as, you know, not really much quality there. And but I did have an awakening, okay? When I went through the first time, I did have an awakening. It was very profound. My mother even said something to me about that I was just so different, you know? And but you see, when you rework the steps, what happens is, when you went through the steps the first time, it brings about an awakening. But now I can go back through the steps and bring that awakening with me and then have a deeper experience with it. In other words, like for instance, in 4 and 5, if I said something to you and withhold some of the truth, so in other words, I omitted some of the full story, I didn't see that as a lie. I only saw lying as I say something that's not the truth. So now when I went back through the steps and I went back through resentment, fear, and harms, and, you know, integrity and truth and honesty and stuff like that, I had a much deeper definition for it. I had a much deeper way of going about it. And now me withholding something was definitely dishonest. And when I went through the first time, I didn't see it that way. So, you know, there's a way of having sort of a deeper experience with it. Also, I've developed some exercises with 2 and 3 and 6 and 7 and many, many exercises with 10 and 11 and other people. I've basically accumulated all of it and put it on my website called Just Love Audio. And if you click on free resources, there's a mega, mega resource on the steps and all the best stuff I've ever found and stuff on meditation and all kinds of stuff, AA history, and I've sort of dedicated my life to what I would call spiritual technology and, you know, step technology, for lack of a better expression, ways of going through the process in a deeper way and in a more effective way than I had heard lots of people talking about for many years in our fellowship. I've heard lots of different ways that never really sounded helpful to me. And I've worked with lots of people, and many of them, after they described to me whatever scary step work that they had done previously, I had to let them know that, you know, as far as I'm concerned, you haven't done any step work, and please stop saying that you have. Mm-hmm. And that's really extreme. I know it's really extreme, but I'd rather go overboard in one direction than in the other direction and co-sign lots of BS. And what I mean by that is like things like, you know, spending 2 years writing your fourth step, spending 6 months doing a fifth step, only making amends to your family because they're the only ones that matter anyway, doing one step a year. The girl didn't come good. I can talk about this. I'm doing a workshop in South Orange currently, and next week is the last session. And I was talking with this girl who was new, and she said something to me that really horrified me. And what she said to me was is that Her sponsor is has a food addiction, but her sponsor likes coming to AA. So she goes to AA. She's not an alcoholic. She has a food addiction, and now she's going around sponsoring people in AA. And she started working with this young lady that I started talking to. And I can't not say something to the sponsor this coming Thursday because I just found it out. She has no right sponsoring alcoholics. I'm not the police of AA, but we don't need any help. Thank you. We don't need any help. And it's funny because she shared a bunch of other stuff. And, you know, of course, there's these compromises. And there's this, you know, I can't relate to her. I talked to her about some stuff that I've done and she just doesn't relate to me. And, you know, of course, she's not even an alcoholic. And you know, I'm not saying she's not well-intentioned. I just, I can't not say something, you know what I mean? And you know, what she ends up doing after I have a conversation with her doesn't matter to me either. But I just can't not say something. It's not okay. It's not okay as far as I'm concerned. The traditions are very clear. Singleness of purpose is very clear. It's very clear. And you know, I see, you know, drug addicts in AA, and you know, whatever, but you know, I just thought this just so far crossed the line of what's acceptable that I should say something, because, you know, I have 26 years now, so it's not that I'm an old timer or something, but, you know, if I'm sorry to put it this way and it sounds like I'm full of myself or whatever you want to call it, but, you know, if somebody like me doesn't say something, who is going to say something? You know, maybe in your mind nothing needs to be said. In my mind, that couldn't be further from the truth. I take a stand. I believe everybody deserves a chance and that there's ideal ways of going about it and there's less than ideal ways of going about it. And I don't know if less than ideal ways of going about it would help anybody. So I talked about that enough. So and then in reworking the steps, what I noticed is in the beginning, one was very much about alcohol and alcoholic behavior. But in reworking the steps a number of times over the years, what the first step has turned into is that when I did it the first time, it was very much about powerlessness and unmanageability in regard to alcohol and sort of behavior associated with when I was drinking. But now step one has turned into a much deeper thing where step one in reworking the steps turns into I'm powerless over life. And when I try to control life, my life becomes unmanageable. So what areas of my life am I trying to play God? And what areas of my life am I trying to run the show? And then, you know, that changes everything for 2 and 3, and it changes, you know, 5 is has all the same basic behaviors. You know, I'm pissed at people, and I'm afraid of things, and I'm harming people. So the manifestation of the problem is all the same, pretty much. But there's a sort of a deeper way of going about it. It's not about alcohol anymore. I haven't drank in 26 years. But I can see, you know, my best thinking. I can see the ways that manipulation is still there. You know what I mean? I still see the ways that I would say, and you're going to be surprised about this, I would say that, you know, with all this extreme step experience that I've had, I find it interesting that it seems that all the same neurosis is still there. There's just subtle degrees of it now. I really do question whether it's even possible for it to all go away. It's just a matter of being hyper aware of it and staying on top of it. Because I haven't seen anything, you know, completely switched or completely new in regard to inventory. So that's what you have to look forward to.
Whatever goes away.
So, hey, listen, maybe you'll find something different. You know, I hope that you do, because I'm sick and tired of me. You know what I mean? I try my best. I try my best, but the mind goes at it the way the mind goes at it, you know. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there's definitely been a big shift with, you know, there's a lot of things that just don't really bother me anymore, and there's a lot of things that I just don't really find important anymore, but it still all comes up, you know what I mean? It still all comes up. My mind still tries to hook me on the same old stuff. And sometimes there's a little bit of a shift, but it's generally all the same. Just kind of interesting to me. I'm almost like an experiment to myself, you know what I mean? It's kind of interesting. And then, so, you know, three, or rather, two talks about came to believe. I think that suggests a process. It doesn't say you now believe. So I've talked to people who, I think some sponsors kind of get it wrong in regard to, you have to have some real faith and some real concept of a higher power before you can then go on to 3 through 9 or whatever you want to call that. And I think that's off. As a matter of fact, I think that the people that I especially prefer working with is somebody who has no spiritual and no religious background at all. Because I know I came from a religious family, and what my sponsor had to do for a bunch of years was I had to unlearn a whole lot of stuff, because what I had internalized wasn't working for me and probably wouldn't work for anybody. Because, you know, in the beginning I had this up there, over there, out there God that was out to get me, you know what I mean? And that wasn't a God that I would want to turn to. Plus sometimes that God isn't here, and that's why... In my workshops, I talk about this constantly, that God is always and already here. God is always and already here. You cannot be separated from God. On your worst day, when you were out there, you were no closer to God than you are today. Now in recovery. When you were at your spiritual best, you were no further away from God than you were when you were at your spiritual worst. You can't be separated from God. God is always and already here. Always and already here. The only thing that separates us from God is a thought. The Course in Miracles says that you're always only one thought away from heaven or hell. So in an instant, you can be in hell. In an instant, you can be judgmental and crazy. And as soon as you notice that you're judgmental and crazy, in an instant, you can be back to contact. The only thing that separates you from God is the mind, because it suggests otherwise. And then it has this interesting trick, and maybe some of you can relate to this, maybe some of you can't. You know, we come into AA, and then, you know, there's this emphasis on seeking, let's call it, and then the mind plays this trick on us, and I want to share it because maybe you can catch yourself. Maybe you can catch yourself with your mind doing this to you, because I think it's a really famous strategy that the mind uses. And what the seeking thing turns into is seek but do not find. You're always seeking but you're not finding. It's about finding. It's about being with. It's not about seeking. Seeking is good, is a good very beginning, but it's about finding. It's not about seeking. So, you know, for years, you know, I went to, you know, meditation workshops and spiritual teacher workshops and stuff. And always at the end of the workshop, I was thinking, oh, when's the next workshop? You know what I mean? Like, I was seeking, but I was not finding. They were talking about, you know, it's here, it's here. Don't look anywhere else, it's here. It's always and already here. Like, and then I'd be like, yeah, but, you know, it's I didn't get what I thought I was going to get, so it's going to be the next workshop that's going to make it happen. You know what I mean? And there was this constant seeking, and there was this efforting to seeking. And then one day I said, oh, it's messing with me. It's messing with me. If I keep listening to it, I'm never going to find it. You know what I mean? It's always and already here. I have to find ways to see and notice that it's always and already here. That's it. That's it, not the seeking. I don't have to go anywhere for it. There's a group of people that talk about, you know, it's the journey that has no distance. It's the journey from head to heart. That's it. We don't have to go anywhere. It's from head to heart. That's it. A journey that has no distance. So seeking is a good beginning, but anywhere after the beginning, it's a strategy that is the losing game. It's a trick. It's a trick of the mind. It's not about knowing knowledge. It's about being wisdom. It's not about knowing knowledge. It's about being wisdom. In other words, there's this really great bumper sticker that I see every once in a while. I really, really love it. And it's funny because I remember when I first saw it, I intellectually tried to disqualify it. I intellectually wanted to fight against it. You know what I mean? Because it's got to be off, but it's not off. And that bumper sticker says, you know, what wisdom can you find that's greater, or what wisdom can you find that's greater than kindness? And, like, I wanted to figure out what wisdom is greater than kindness. You know, I'm, like, trying to figure it out. I'm a pseudo-intellectual, you know? And then finally I said, there is no wisdom greater than kindness. That's it. That's being wisdom, is being kind. It's being wisdom. It's not knowing knowledge. It's about being wisdom. We're already there. We can do this. It's not a giant leap. The third step is not some grand changing of your mind. The third step is made a decision to turn my will and my life over to the care of God as I understand Him. Who gave me my will in the first place? God. Who gave me my life in the first place? God. Step three is just a default. Step three is a reset button back to reality. We don't have to get somewhere to turn our will and life over to God. God's in charge. The third step is merely an acceptance of reality. Something that we're not any good at. We want to argue with reality from now until the day we die. We want to argue with reality. And when you argue with reality, you lose but 100% of the time. My son shouldn't have done that. Yeah, but your son did do that. Traffic shouldn't have done that. But traffic did do that. So is it true to tell myself a story that it shouldn't be that way? Because it is that way. I want to argue with it. I have to get my way. I have to get my way. Because my mind tells me, if I get my way, then I'll be all right. And you know what? I got my way many times. I still was never all right. So wait a minute. It's tricking me again. This stinking mind is tricking me again. It's screwing me again. And you know what? It's not screwing me. Because, you see, the mind isn't the problem. Me believing the mind is the problem. The mind is just there to throw up thoughts. Think me, think me, think me. We've all experienced not following the mind. We've all experienced it. We've all experienced being somewhere, and a thought comes in our heads that person just disrespected me, I'm going to go over them, I'm going to choke them. And then we get up and we start moving toward them. We're just like, wait a minute, no, I'm not going to do that. I'm not going to do that. We've all experienced disregarding a thought. We're never more than one thought away from heaven and hell. The mind creates a problem and then wants us to turn to it for the solution. And even worse, the mind gets us to do something we know we shouldn't be doing. And then after we do it, it beats us up for doing it. Wait a minute, the mind just got me to do what I shouldn't have, what I knew I shouldn't do, and then now it's going to make me feel bad about having done that. The mind is not a helpful inner resource, except when it comes to, you know, work and driving a car. The mind is, like, really good at, you know what I mean? But it's really, really bad when it comes to successful relationships. It's really, really bad when it comes to living a problem-free life. Every problem you've ever had, every single problem you've ever had, you created. You believed the thought. Every single problem you've ever had, It's not what they do that's the problem. It's what I tell myself about what they do that's the problem. There's a really great quote that goes, "We all have a Grand Central Station mind, but we don't have to get on every train that comes through the station." This is what spirituality begins to become. Spirituality begins to become, I have a completely different relationship with my mind. I have a completely different relationship with my thought system. Completely different relationship. And the coolest thing is that sometimes the mind is sort of over here, chattering away at, oh, you know, they shouldn't have done that. They, you know, they're talking at you. You know what I mean? Nobody's speaking, but, you know, I'm a mind reader. You know what I mean? All of a sudden, they're thinking at me. You know what I mean? Like, we are the worst mind readers in the world. Right? See, she relates. She totally relates. Right? They're thinking at me, right? My friend Chris loves that phrase. And it's completely laughable, but is it? Because most people live their whole lives and don't notice exactly what I'm talking about right now. Most people live their whole lives and then they die. And they don't notice that their mind created every problem that they ever had. And the cool thing is about us is that our mind screwed us so bad and for so long, we need to consider another way. Because, you know, we got misery or the unknown. And misery, the book talks about it when he gets into four, that, you know, resentment is of our own making. Fear is of our own making. Either because of what we did or didn't do, or definitely because of what we're choosing to think about it. Thanks for letting me share.
Thank you very much. Okay.